Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to All Stats Aren't We, a podcast in which Leeds fans cast their combined eye over goings on at Elland Road, giving scrutiny to the underlying statistics and tactical footings at work at Leeds United. I'm John McKenzie, the, oh great, football has died of the podcast. It was nice while it lasted. And I'm joined by the Adam Forshaw didn't die for this of the podcast, Joe Hill. Seriously, 80 minutes of football and it's already over. And finally, the, oh yeah, we also drew with Liverpool of the podcast. It's getting boring taking points off all of these super leagues. It's Tom Woodhead. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad. I enjoyed watching us stick one in the eye of whatever the hell we're sticking things in the eye of nowadays. Last night, it was good.
Yeah, and Joe Hill, how are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. It's hard to sort of separate the two things at the moment, I thought. Like the game last night and obviously all the other chat about the Super League, it sort of has a weird feeling around it. And you sort of have to remember that, oh, we actually got a decent result against Liverpool, and you know, following from the Man City game, the last two games have actually been really good results wise so we kind of have to just remember that.
I was saying to you guys before, like, I have a lot of friends who work in the football industry, and it's meant that I've been feeling quite flat the last few days, because I guess and events like the events that we've seen over the last few days have really sort of laid bare what modern football is about. And I think the tricky thing about all of this is that you know there's so much good stuff in football, and there's so much of that good stuff that's just completely mired in the bad stuff about football, that it becomes very, very tricky to sort of extricate yourself from one or the other. And so yeah, it's been a funny few days, and as a result I found the game yesterday quite flat. It not that it felt pointless, but it just sort of felt a little bit overwhelming in certain ways. So hopefully that won't really come across in my analysis in the next hour, but it was a good game, and it was a game where, again, I think we saw the tactics shift things for the better in the second half. So I think there is stuff to talk about. Before we get to that, though, we do talk a lot about Adam Forshaw on this channel, for very good reason, I like to think. But Adam Forshaw did have a return to televised football, at least, on Friday night. He got 83 minutes against Aston Villa under 23s. I don't know if either of you two caught it. I know that you, Tom Woodhead, did catch a bit of it. I've watched the game back. Unfortunately, I was playing football at the time, so I wasn't able to watch it live. But Tom, I'll go with you first on this. What did you make of Forshaw's return?
I thought he was good. I watched basically the last 10 minutes of the first half and all of the second half, basically. And yeah, I thought he looked sprightly. He looked pretty fit, all things considered. He looked tidy, as he always does. He misplaced one or two passes, but not very many. It was quite hard to tell from the angle that LUTV you were using what was going on off the ball, but whenever he was on the ball, he looked pretty much like his old self, in as much as you can tell from under 23's football.
Yeah, I think for me, a lot of what I've been looking at when I've been watching him back now is just his, how he looks in terms of his physiology. And he does look, I thought he would come back looking maybe a little bit slower, maybe a little bit more lethargic, but he does look sharp. And as you said, you know, he didn't. Obviously, we're going to have to see how scalable it is. It's all well and good playing well against Aston Villa under 23s, no doubt a good under 23 side, but not really a great correlate for Premier League football. But he looked as though you could easily throw him into a Premier League game late on, see how he would fare. And he didn't look like he would be miles off the pace for me. But Joe Hill, I don't know if you managed to catch any of Forshaw.
I caught a little bit, yeah. I was sort of in and out of the game as it was happening, and then watched some highlights afterwards. And I've obviously seen that lovely little reverse pass that he made. I don't know which half it was in, but we've all seen it on the highlights. But it was obviously just nice to see him back. And I agree that he did look sharper than I expected. I sort of agree with you that I did expect to see him looking a bit slower and, you know, maybe a bit tentative. But he looked like he was really up for it. And I think it'll be a nice benchmark for him. I'm sure he'll be really keen to play this season. It seems achievable. I think we've got six odd games left, six or seven. So we're talking the last couple of games of the season, presumably. But if he can get on as from off the bench for one of those games, then that'll be a great benchmark for him and for all the Leeds fans that have been missing him all this time.
It's an interesting one because I don't think the club would have persevered with him this long. I mean, it's been nearly 2 years, hasn't it? So I can't imagine they would have persevered that long unless they thought there was a real chance that he was going to be fit and healthy and okay to play Premier League football. So I suppose in that sense, there's a level of logic to the fact that he is playing as well as he is at the moment. I don't think we would have seen him playing in the under-23s if he wasn't at the standard where he was going to be able to play for the under-23s. So it feels very much to me that as though the club are saying, we're happy with where he's at, happy enough that we would play him, and we're not just going to dump him in the 23s just to see how he does. We know that he's good enough to play there, and we're going to see if we can just get enough miles in his legs and minutes under his belt so that he can potentially come on at some point. I guess this does raise questions about the transfer policy in the summer. Tom Woodhead, I don't know if you have any opinions on that. Do you think it will mean that we don't see another central midfielder coming in?
If he manages to make it to the end of the season without any further breakdowns or anything like that, it wouldn't surprise me if that factors into the thinking in some way. I guess Forshaw is not a player who's ever been overly reliant on physicality or pace or anything like that. So it's not like he's a winger who's going to be, or, you know, like a Michael Owen type striker whose main attributes are going to be significantly diminished if he is a tiny bit slower than he was. And especially if he's not expected to be a first choice player, if he's going to be someone who can come in for either Phillips or a possible midfield signing or Dallas that we make, then I think it's always going to be a risk, isn't it? But it could be a calculated risk that allows us, for example, to buy a right-footed winger when we otherwise wouldn't have had the money to do it or something like that. So it seems crazy to take a risk on Forshaw when he's got the record that he's got, but Bielsa was always on about how professional he'd been throughout his period out and that he'd kept his physical standards up. And it seems, from what I've heard, that the injury that he had, it was to do with specific movements involving playing football rather than anything just fully wrong with his hip. Or was it his hip or his groin? I'm never quite sure. But it sounds like he's been able to, I don't know whether that's swimming or cycling or whatever, but keep physically fit the entire time, like throughout the injury. So it's not that he's coming back from a baseline of no fitness at all. He's coming back from a very high baseline in terms of metabolism and things, and in terms of just being a fit man at that sort of age. So, you know, fingers crossed if they've actually got to the root of the problem, and only the club really know if they have or not, and they probably don't even know, but if they have, then I'd be perfectly happy to see him as a member of the squad who can contribute.
I'm very much not a physiotherapist, but I did play a lot of football between the ages of 18 and 30 pretty much, and towards the end of my time I started getting a huge amount of problems with my hips, and a lot of this comes down to the fact that the pelvis is a sort of, I guess it's a sort of ring of bone, and there's a lot of tension in that ring. And what you get is, as soon as one thing affects you on one side, it will tweak things on the other side as well. So there's a lot of things that are all in very fine alignment, I suppose, in that area. And what I was told when I was going through, I went through a lot of physio. What I was told is that a lot of footballers don't do enough deep core or lower core exercise when they're training, because you don't really see any benefit from it, obviously, because it's sort of all sort of deep pelvic stuff, and the problem then becomes is that you start then throwing out a lot of the alignments. You get sort of muscle imbalances and stuff which can throw things out, and I'm sure something like that has happened for him. And for me, again, it was the same. I could do loads of exercise if I wanted to, but there were certain movements that I couldn't do when I was playing towards the end, some of which involved like hitting the ball hard with one of my feet, because the hip flexor just couldn't take the strain, really. And I'm sure it's something like that that he's basically gone through. So yeah, it will be good to see him come back. And I think if we play him as a backup player who we can have on the bench, who we're not going to put a huge amount of pressure on in terms of making appearances, then he'll be definitely a benefit to us. And I think he's definitely a profile of player that we've missed in the last couple of seasons. We've really not actually replaced him in any way, because we've always had this sort of injury stuff dragging on for 2 years. And, you know, it felt as though, I mean, he went off and at the beginning of last season and came back on for half against Charlton when we lost the game. Yeah. And at that point, like, none of us were thinking, well, that's it, you know, we're not going to see him. We just thought it was a sort of few days out and then he'll be back.
I don't think he was either. I think he expected to be back fairly soon. And throughout, that's been one of the running themes, hasn't it? That Forshaw, whenever he's quoted, has always said, I'll be back pretty soon. Yeah, he thought he was going to possibly play after lockdown last season. So it's obviously been immensely frustrating for him as well.
No doubt the club were expecting him to come back much quicker than he actually has. But one final question on Forshaw, I suppose, in terms of like, what difference do you think that Forshaw would make to this team, given that we basically had to sort of belt and braces patch up the midfield with Stuart Dallas? Joe, what do you think that this season might have looked like if we'd have been able to play a fit Forshaw from the off?
One of the biggest benefits to having him fit would have been having cover for Calvin when he's been out. When Calvin's been out and someone's had to step in, like Strauch or Llorente or Koch, you know, it's just not made any sense. And the whole team sort of had to move around and everyone's had to shift positions because of that. And I think that's, I'm not sure if it's the biggest thing that we would have got from him, but that's certainly a big contribution. And obviously the other thing is that midfield structure, where we've seen Dallas playing this new role this season, and it might have been that could be Forshaw's role and that Dallas would assert his place at left back, and then we wouldn't have so many issues with Alioski, who probably is our weakest player in the starting 11. I think most people would agree with that. So I think it's more the knock-on effects of us plugging the gaps of him being out and what that means for the team in terms of everyone rotating positions. So if it means that we can have a centre-back pairing playing 10, 15, 20 games in a row, Forshaw being fit, that is, then obviously that's going to be a huge benefit to us.
I think some of the other things, some of the more chaotic losses, I think we think like losing to Leicester 4-1 and things like that, I don't think we would have seen so many of those runaway scorelines with Forshaw in the team, because I don't think centre-backs would maybe be able to run through us in quite the same way as they did in some of those games. I think we would have had overall a bit more solidity, and we've achieved that solidity a different way now. Bielsa's worked out a way to do it by sticking Dallas in the middle, but I think we wouldn't have had so much of a problem in the first place. We wouldn't, you know, Scott McTominay might not have scored two goals in the first 5 minutes or whatever it was against Manchester United. So I think in general there would have been a bit less chaos.
Well, we could talk about Adam Forshaw for a whole hour, I'm sure, but we should move on and talk about the game yesterday. I'll begin, as we always do, with how did that feel? I think we've already touched on this a little bit, but how did the game itself feel to you, Tom?
The first half was difficult. I don't think we ever really got out of the traps. I don't think we were under the cosh quite as much as we were in that first game against Manchester City, but it was following a relatively similar pattern in that Liverpool were doing most of the attacking. They're still not in great form, so I don't think they didn't have the kind of guile that City had in that first 20 minutes, where it did seem like they were really carving us open at will. And I think actually Liverpool could have, if Liverpool were at the top of their game, I think they could have easily scored a couple of goals in that first like quarter of an hour or something. But we held them off. I think in general our penalty box defending was quite good, even if some of our defending in the middle of the park wasn't so great in that first half. And then second half, credit to the players, because I didn't see a clear way for us to come back into that game. I couldn't see anything obvious to change, and I don't think anything hugely obvious did change about the way we were playing. I think we asserted ourselves, because Liverpool got a little bit nervy and started dropping back a bit, and that allowed it. And once we were in the game and creating chances on a semi-regular basis, I think our team is like that, isn't it? It builds up momentum like a stone rolling down a hill, and we were able to do that. And then that second half, I think we played really well, but it was one of those weird things where I was watching the second half, and you know, it gets to about 70 minutes and I suddenly think, actually, we have played really well this second half. And it almost crept up on me without me noticing it, because I was still in that sort of first half mindset. But I think it was definitely a deserved point. And I was surprised when I saw the XG that we, according to the XG that I saw at the time, we beat them by a clear goal, which I was actually quite surprised at, because it seemed a lot more even than that to me.
The thing I would say is that Liverpool did feel as though they weren't as sharp as they usually would in the attacking phases. I think there's a lot of moments where Liverpool in previous seasons would have scored. They would have, or at least had very good chances and hit the target. There's a few chances where we gave the ball away in silly scenarios and ended up not even conceding a shot on target. So I think there's maybe a little bit to be used as a caveat there. I also think there's a couple of chances. I've just looked back through the InfoGoal XG figures, which isn't ideal. I would prefer to go through the StatsBomb XG figures on FB Ref, but they're not up yet. But they've included a couple of chances where, had the goal been scored, they would have been chalked off, and so they wouldn't have counted towards XG. There was a Pat Bamford one where he swept the ball wide in the first half from a free kick, I think it was. And then there was the Helder Costa one at the back post, and they were both fairly good chances. So there's a big chunk of XG that was from them. But yeah, certainly balancing off those two things, it was a deserved point for me, especially on the basis of the second half. But
we played better than we did against City as well, which I think is important to say.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I do think that, even again watching the game back this morning, I was a little bit surprised at how many good chances Liverpool had in the second half, because it did feel as though we sort of steamrolled them a little bit in the second half. But again, there was a break where they were 3-on-2 and they didn't even manage to get a shot on target. There was the Melier chance where he just gave the ball straight to Salah, and Pascal Strouk defended it quite well. There was another chance where Salah got in behind and just dragged the ball past the post. So there was definitely chances they could have had that they could have scored, which you would have thought on balance they probably would have done in previous seasons. But this season they looked poor yesterday. I was surprised at how poor Liverpool looked for me. I know that there are all kinds of caveats for that as well, and we can get onto that in a bit, but they didn't really look dangerous in any way, I didn't think. But yeah, Joe, I'll give you a chance to say how it felt for you as well.
Yeah, I agree with what you chaps are saying. I think a draw is probably the fair result, and obviously we have to caveat Liverpool's performance with their injury crisis. That's just, you know, this just the obvious thing to say, really. Even last night they had Fabinho playing centre back, which he hasn't been doing because it's been Phillips and Kabak, and they've sort of formed quite a good partnership from a Liverpool point of view. So they did have players out of position, and obviously Henderson wasn't playing. But I think a draw is probably fair. I think, like you say, both teams had really big chances. Liverpool's didn't end up resulting in shots on target as much as they should have done. Like you mentioned, those two Salah ones. And then Leeds, I think we could have been a bit more clinical. Like Roberts in the second half, Roberts' chance was just huge. I mean, as soon as that ball is played through from Poveda, it just looks like a certain goal. It just looks like he has to slot it past the keeper. And I think maybe he loses his composure slightly and just tries to welly it as hard as he can. And Alisson couldn't have even gotten out of the way if he tried. It was just straight at him. So I think given all of that, a draw was probably a fair result. And yeah, we probably could have gone on to win had we taken our chances a bit better. But equally, Liverpool, the same thing applies to Liverpool. So yeah, I think overall it felt pretty good. And it was, like I said earlier, it was masked by all the Super League stuff. But when I isolate the game in my mind, I'm pretty happy with it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, so let's get into the questions then. We had, as always, quite a few questions, too many to fit them all in, so do bear with us. But thank you for sending them in. We do read all of them and we do try and get the representative ones there. I'd like to start off by covering a bit of the Super League stuff. Because I do think that it's something which does impact us as a club, and it's something that I at least feel as though I want to get some things off my chest. Arnie B said, do we care? Not really, but the Rebel Alliance get a late draw against the Galactic Empire. obviously, that's narrating the events in a certain way. I don't necessarily have a problem with that, but I'll put this over to you guys. How do you feel about the whole European Super League phenomenon that we've seen unfolding in the last few days? I'll start with you, Tom.
I think I feel like most people feel it's an abomination, if that's not too strong a word to use, about something to do with football. It's taking a fundamental thing about what makes football great, which is the fact that you can get promoted and relegated, and just the fundamental inability or unwillingness to understand that from the clubs involved. I think it is more unwillingness, really. They'll pretend like even if they back out of this, they'll pretend that they weren't aware of the level of sentiment that was going to be against it. But it's absolute bollocks. Of course they were aware. They just thought, you know, maybe we'll get away with this. There's no fans in stadiums. Let's not pretend that this isn't just a symptom of a wider malaise that's been in football for a long time, and a wider, you know, steamroller that's been on the horizon for years and years and has been coming closer and closer. And even if it's seen off, they'll keep trying. They'll keep trying until something is done about it, either through legislation or through changing the laws of football, or they have to be told to, like, made to fuck off, basically. We can't keep having this process of we'll mollify them with some concessions, because, you know, you give them an inch, they will take a mile every single time, and they'll keep taking miles until there's nothing else left.
Those are wise words, and I think the majority of the fan base will agree with them. Joe, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think what I want to add, I mean, obviously everyone's feeling the same. Every football fan is feeling the same about this. And I think where it strikes me is just thinking about what football means to me and what it meant to me growing up and that kind of thing. Like, when you're a kid and you're playing football on the streets or in the playground or in the park, it's just that sense of community, and you just dream of winning the World Cup, or you dream of winning the FA Cup final. And the narrative that we have in England with this football pyramid is that teams from the bottom can work their way up, get promoted, and take on the big teams, take on the big six and the other teams in the Premier League. And just to eradicate that and to abandon that footballing pyramid that has been around for far longer than anyone involved has been alive. It's just horrible to see. And the one thing that worries me, obviously there's lots of things that worry me, but the one thing that worries me about what will happen if they reverse the decision is that the top six will try and use this for leverage to get more money in the Premier League for the top six, or to alter the Champions League format to the way they want it to be. And I do worry that this was almost part of the plan all along, to announce this huge breakaway Super League thing, and then to reduce that and say, okay, well, we're not going to do the Super League, but here are our demands, because we'll be so generous to you, and we will play in your silly Champions League and your silly Premier League, but we need these demands. And that is what worries me if they happen to back down from this.
The thing is, how many clubs are even ever winning anything? Like, most clubs never win anything at the top level. If you ask fans of most clubs about what their favourite ever moments supporting their team are, it usually is some kind of David versus Goliath story, like the kinds of stories that they just want to completely eradicate from football. Like, if you know, ask most Leeds, a lot of Leeds fans anyway, before Bielsa arrived, what's your favourite moment supporting Leeds in the last 10 years, 10, 15 years? A lot of people would talk about beating Man United in the FA Cup in 2008. And obviously that's not league-based, but that's the kind of thing that they want to do away with. They don't want the opportunity to be embarrassed. They don't want the opportunity to fail. They just want to be these kind of monoliths who will always be there and will always get some bizarre kind of respect. And obviously, in the end of the day, it's all about money, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's the history of football in the last 30, 40 years has been about how clubs have been able to guarantee that they can have income. There's a realisation, I think, particularly in the last year with the football market contracting because of COVID, because of the general global economy contracting because of COVID, that I think there's a bit of a panic amongst the big clubs that you know, an already fairly unprofitable system is going to become less profitable for them. And this is just a sort of power grab. It's a bid for them to take all of the money from across the pyramid and try and get as much of it for themselves. And you know, it's elitism pure and simple, and it should worry us, because it is, like you said, it's a metaphor for a more, I guess, pervasive malaise that infects modern society, in that people at the top just seem hell bent on getting more and more control, more and more money, and people at the bottom who they rely on, let's not forget, are the ones who lose out. And I think that's what really galls me about this, is that the idea that the top 15 clubs are the most important in football, because it's simply not true. Everything that is good about the elite levels of football is fundamentally dependent upon every level of football, all the way down to the grassroots. That, you know, football talent doesn't develop out of nowhere. The players who are playing in those teams, yes, okay, they may have been picked up at a young age by academies, but they were playing at local clubs around the UK for the English players, around Europe for the European players. It just doesn't happen from nowhere. And what you're essentially saying by saying we are going to take the biggest chunk of the money for ourselves and keep it for ourselves is, we actually don't value you as the small man. And I think, you know, it goes, this is what Gary Neville was saying so eloquently yesterday, is that, you know, it's not even as if the clubs care about the players. The clubs haven't even told the players that this is happening. The owners haven't really told the players what's happening, and they've just sort of thrown them under the bus and been like, you're going to be the ones who face the flak here. They literally do not care for football. They care about making money, using football as a way of making money. And so, yeah, I'm just going to end by saying, when people say football is for the fans and football belongs to the fans, I think a lot of the time it's sort of hat tip stuff, but I do think there's a fundamental sense in which we need to remember as Leeds fans that the club does belong to us. It doesn't belong to Andrea Radrizzani. It didn't belong to Massimo Cellino. It didn't belong to Ken Bates. The club belongs to us as fans. And I think for too long, we've just sort of allowed these people to run roughshod over what the club does. So, I'm not going to add much more to what you guys have said, other than say, you know, we are the true owners of the club, and I think it's down to us in some sense to make it known how displeased we are about the way that things are going.
Absolutely, I agree. And the other thing I would say is that one of the excuses that they're coming out with for why this needs to happen is that, you know, the sense that some kind of bubble is going to burst and the finances aren't sustainable anymore because of COVID, etc. But the bubble needs to burst. Like, it's too, like, that's the whole fucking point of the bubble. Like, it gets really big and then it bursts because it's too big. Like, there is too much money in football. You don't need the amount of, you know, players are getting paid so much money, and I don't blame the players for taking it, but is there really going to be any material difference in, you know, Lionel Messi's lifestyle if he's earning 50 grand a week compared to £500,000 a week, or I don't even know what he earns anymore. But it gets to a point where the extra money is not even doing anything. It's not making the game better. It's not improving the standard, which is what they will claim it's doing. I'm not against any money being in football at all. I'm not saying they should all go back to being amateurs, but there comes a point where the extra money is not bringing anything new to the game.
Well, we're halfway through this podcast and we've barely talked about the result yesterday. So,
but our glorious draw with Liverpool.
Or Merseyside Reds, as the club so classily put it. But let's talk about the football, because that's what we do try and do on this channel. So I think the big question that was on everyone's lips is what happened between the first and the second half. So James said, love to hear your breakdown between the first and second half. What changed? Edward Atterton said, I think first half similar to the City game, pre-sending off deeper, more conservative, but still aggressive counter-attacking. Second half opened the game up, relying on fitness. Part of the second half was like first City game, and 15 minutes at the end was like those Championship games we dominated. And then Mike Turetsky said, seemed like we were defending too deep in the first half. Were we still in the shadows of Man City backs to the wall performance? Joe, I'll go to you first on this. What's your sort of sense on this switch between first and second half?
I think if I was to sum it up, I think that Liverpool dropped off, to be honest. I think they were pressing really aggressively in the first half, and in the second half it sort of looked like they dropped off a little bit and just allowed us to have the ball a little bit more, particularly towards the end. I think Pervada made a huge impact when he came on. I think it was one of his best games for Leeds. He looked really exciting, and he looked like what I want to see in a winger. When they receive one of those diagonal balls from the centre-backs and they're facing the full-back, I always just want to see them take him on. I don't know why. I mean, obviously, I appreciate a nicely whipped-in cross, but I just want to see a bit of skill. I want to see them get past their man and be aggressive going into the box. And I think Pervada did that really well. And I think the combination of those two things allowed us to have a lot more possession. And I do agree, one of those questions mentioned the fitness thing, and I think that did play a big part as well, because we all know a team can't press as aggressively as Liverpool did in the first half for 90 minutes. It's just not possible. They have to drop and sit back at some point. And I think they were feeling it. I think Liverpool were feeling it the last 15 minutes, and they just tried to hold on. And it was probably a mentality thing for them as well, knowing that they're not in such good form. They just thought, okay, we need to sit back and kill this game off on the counter-attack. Unfortunately for us, they didn't manage to do it.
I thought Edward's summation of what happened was pretty good, to be honest. And I do agree, we probably were defending too deep in the first half as well. So, I think... Yeah, I wouldn't add too much.
The only thing that I would add is that Calvin Phillips' role basically changed in the two halves. So in the first half, Phillips was playing pretty much a bit of a zonal position as well in terms of the man marking, because I think the way that Liverpool were set up was that they had their two wide players quite narrow, and Firmino was dropping in quite deep. And in the first half, Phillips was doing a lot of man-to-man on Firmino and out of possession. For Liverpool, Firmino was doing a lot of man-to-man on Phillips. And so I think what that meant was that Phillips ended up playing a little bit deeper, and also meant that Leeds weren't covering the centre midfielders very well. There's a moment in the game in the first half that I shared a screenshot with you guys where Alisson picks up the ball and he's just able to roll the ball out to Wijnaldum in the centre of the field. Absolutely no one around him. And I think that's because Roberts, who is nominally marking Wijnaldum, was picking up Thiago, who was nominally being marked by Calvin Phillips, who was actually marking Firmino. So it ended up that the Leeds press was just really inefficient in the first half in particular, and it meant that Liverpool didn't have to do a huge amount to transition the ball through the thirds. In the second half, and a lot of people have pointed this out actually, Calvin Phillips was just man-marking Thiago, and it meant that because Thiago likes to drop deep to pick the ball up, that Phillips was pushing quite far up the field. And that more aggressive press, the man-mark from us, was actually much more beneficial to the way that we were playing. And then obviously if you add that on top of the fact that, as you've mentioned, Liverpool's higher press dropped off. James Milner mentioned in the post-match interview that that they were tired from the Madrid game as well. And it's easy to forget that the Liverpool have played a lot of games in a short space of time, all of which are nominally quite important. I know the Madrid game maybe not quite as important as it might have been, given it looked like they were going out, but it's still, you still have to travel to another country, play a game, and then come back and then prepare for your next game with not a huge amount of turnaround. So I think it's just a combination of those things. I've got a piece that I'm going to put up, I think today, looking at the future, how Leeds should plan for the future. And a lot of that comes down to the way that they approach their press and their man marking. And I think I was really frustrated in the first half because our pressing has been poor, I think, recently, partly because we have been conservative, partly because we are scared letting centre-backs run through the middle. And weirdly, it happened more in the first half when we were being more conservative yesterday than it did in the second half when we were being a bit more aggressive. And I think a lot of what makes us quite handy in the Premier League is our ability to do that man marking and get the pressing right. Obviously, when it goes wrong, it looks awful and horrible. And I think we've maybe lost our nerve a little bit after the Manchester United result. But I was glad to see in the second half, we sort of went back to basics, or it went at least went back to what we did well at the beginning of the season. And it certainly seemed to pay off for me. So I don't know if you guys have got any thoughts on that.
It might be the case that now we sort of need to get to the end of the season and the players need to have a new preseason to reset that and reset that mentality of being a bit more aggressive. Like I can sort of understand why, when you keep getting hammered 4, 5, 6 goals, why you would naturally become more conservative. So especially when we've got Man United again next, where I can't see that we're going to suddenly become really pressy again, when, you know, that's the fixture we've been found out the most in all season.
Let's move on to talk about the defence in general. So the view from 27A says, we feel much more robust and confident defensively over the last 7 to 8 games. Is this just Llorente's impact, Dallas in midfield, or is there a tactical adaptation that's making us harder to beat? Joe Hill, what's your thoughts on that?
It's interesting. I think it's all a reaction. It's similar to what we were just talking about, but I think it's a reaction to the game at Old Trafford and getting beat 6-2, getting beat by Chelsea, those games, and the reaction after it from the press. I think that's sparked a change in Bielsa, and I think that's why we're seeing a bit more defensively robust performances, because Bielsa does pay attention to the press and he does pay attention to how his team are received. If you remember when we were in the Championship, there was that game where we suggested playing the short corner to Bielsa in the presser before the Middlesbrough game, and then we did it, and then Click scored that goal against Middlesbrough, and it just reminded me of that, because it feels a bit like Bielsa is looking at the reaction from those games early on in the season and thinking, okay, well, we're getting criticised for playing all-out attack and having these crazy games, which maybe Bielsa doesn't even mind if we win them. But now let's show that we can be defensive. And I think those things that the question has mentioned do contribute. I think Dallas in midfield does contribute a lot. I think Llorente's impact, you know, we debate that a lot in our chat, and we debated it before on the podcast. I think some of his passing was really good yesterday, and I think that helped us break the press a couple of times. So I think the combination of all those things is probably allowing us to be a bit more defensive. But I do agree with what Tom said in that a good break and a pre-season might just help us reset and work out some proper way of doing this, some kind of balance between the all-out attack and the all-out defence.
I do feel as though the summer is going to be quite important. I've mentioned the piece that I'm going to put out later, and that's kind of my question. My question is, we're almost at a crossroads in terms of the way that we're playing at the moment. It feels as though we have that choice to either go down the route of being like a high-pressing, a man-marking system that's pretty total, or we can maybe drop into what we've been doing more recently, which is a little bit more zonal marking in the midfield areas. I think, you know, Dallas was doing it, has been doing it, and Calvin Phillips was doing it, as I said, suggested it really in the first half. And I suppose my attitude is always, we just look better when our press is on. And the problem has been that we've not been able to press properly for various reasons this season. mostly I would put it down to Rodrigo not being able to engage in the press as well as maybe we would need. And so I'm interested to see where we go this summer. Do we go back to that really sort of intense pressing, marking approach, or do we maybe become a little bit more muted in that sense? And I suppose my worry is that sort of trajectory is kind of what I saw from Sheffield United in their time in the Premier League. And I worry that just sort of making sure that you're not embarrassing yourself in the league is worrying, because we got to safety pretty much by playing gung-ho football, which could go wrong or could go amazingly. And I think playing more conservatively means you lose your edge a little bit in those games where you need to be winning. So I've said a lot there. I'll give you a chance to talk about this, Tom, because I think this is quite an interesting aspect of the future for Leeds.
I mean, you mentioned Rodrigo. I think in terms of being solid, I do think that's coincided with Rodrigo being injured as well. I think we are generally a lot more solid when he's not in the team, and he does bring things to the team in an attacking sense. But I think Roberts is a much better marker and keeps us more solid in that sense. But I think in terms of the summer and what we do next season, I think Bielsa, I think his idealism reflares in the summer. I don't... Even if there are some things that towards the end of the season he might get a little bit more pragmatic about, which I think did happen in his first season to an extent as well, when we when after the Wigan game, I think, and the Derby playoff game and stuff, I think possibly not quite so crazy in some elements until it really went crazy. But that wasn't anything to do with tactics. I think he'll redouble his efforts, and he usually, every preseason so far, he's found some tweak to the team that's changed things a little bit. And I think the idealism will be his starting point. I don't think he'll start from a position of, oh, well, we were a bit more pragmatic and improved in this way, so let's go from there. I think he'll go back to the root. How do we want to play, and how can we make that happen? And I don't think he'll think just because, oh, we've been a bit less pressy in the second half of this season, we need to continue in that vein. I just don't see him as that kind of personality and that kind of thinker, really.
And I think games like yesterday's game will probably help in that regard as well, where I think the more aggressive approach clearly carried dividends with it, and the more muted conservative approach really didn't.
I think some of it's the players as well. I don't think it's all necessarily Bielsa telling them to do things. Especially the Man City game, they all basically said that it was all they could do. And it's players to a certain extent making decisions for themselves, which I think is a good thing in the context of the squad and in the context of players being more adaptable in the system as well. When they're able to make their own decisions, I think that's a good thing. But equally, I think Bielsa, he will be drilling some new ideas into them in pre-season and redoubling down on some core principles as well.
And again, it will depend on who we bring in the summer to what the team will look like next year. Let's move on. We had lots of questions about players, so let's get into some of those. Firstly, Pascal Strauch. Stuart McLaughlin says, how long will you talk about Pascal Strauch for? To be fair, he's my man of the match, but if you'd be kind enough to sound a warning whilst you will wet yourselves for 15 minutes so I can skip it, would be appreciated. So, Stuart, you've got 15 minutes to skip because we're going to talk about Pascal Strauch here. Tom, what did you make of Pascal yesterday?
I thought he was good. I honestly didn't think it was one of his best performances for us. I thought he was about par for the rest of the team. He's always pretty good, I think, and I thought he was pretty good again. But yeah, I don't think I would have given him man of the match. I'm not sure who I would give it to, but I think he made a couple of errors that maybe would disqualify him from that award for me. In fact, I would definitely have given it to Ayling, because I thought it was Ayling's best game in ages. But yeah, I thought he was fine. He was good. He is good. There's your 15 minutes.
Yeah, I agree with Tom. I think I don't think I quite realised how good his passing was until I saw some of the highlights this morning. I mean, that they are highlights by definition, so maybe that's unfair that if they missed a couple of clangers. But certainly those passes looked like they were pretty key to our build-up play, switching to the wingers. One of the things that I was thinking about Pascal this morning, compared to Llorente, because we were sort of talking about how they both look when they play, how they both run and how they both move their bodies. And I think Pascal is just really cool and calm, and he looks great when he's doing it. For some reason, it made me think that if they were on Strictly Come Dancing, that that Pascal would be doing these amazing waltzes and Argentine tangos and stuff, and Llorente would be the one that's just trying this bollocks dance. He's trying the samba or something, and his just arms are flailing everywhere. And yeah, I think that does sort of contribute to how we see them both, because they both had good points and they both had bad points yesterday. But Pascal looked like his cool self as usual, which is always nice.
Yeah, I thought it was a good game from Pascal Strout yesterday. I think he is just consistent, does pretty much everything well. I think he got turned once by Diogo Jota, which led to a fairly decent chance. But apart from that, I thought he did everything well. And as you said, Josh Hobbs has a highlights video out just showing his distribution, which I think often gets overlooked at how good his distribution is. And interesting that you mentioned the sort of aesthetic differences between Llorente and Strout. And I agree. I think that probably goes both ways. I think when it comes to defending, Strout just looks better than Llorente because he looks more in control. He's smoother. He's a pretty calm player. But also I think it goes the other way as well. I think sometimes Llorente, he hits the ball so weirdly that I think people read it as being like incredible disguise, but I just genuinely think that's the way he hits the ball. So maybe sometimes when Pascal kind of booms those big balls down into the channels, that sounds really bad, but yeah, I think he just looks a lot smoother doing it. You know, he it almost looks as though, oh, he's not really done anything that special too. So I think the aesthetics thing goes both ways. And I think we're just in a scenario where we've got a nice mix of centre backs now. And I certainly think that Pascal Strouk will be in with a shout of maybe playing a full season for us next year, being the starting centre back next season. Will depend on obviously Cooper, but you know, it just seems to have been a general trend this season that we've sort of had Cooper in and out of the team, and whenever Strout's come in, he's just come in and looked really solid. And I think the biggest thing for me about Strout is that he's clearly a confidence player, and his confidence is just building and building and building in every game through the season. It's got to a point now where I don't even worry about him in many respects coming into the games, which I did earlier on in the season, partly because I wanted him to do well. But also now it's just kind of like, yeah, he's a solid Premier League centre-back. You don't need to worry about him. Occasionally he'll make mistakes, but that's kind of par for the course for any centre back in the system that we're playing. And you just want to know that over the course of 10 games he's going to have a level of consistency which is going to be good. So I think that's the way we have to look at it, really. Someone who has, again, a little bit of a lot of the problem when we talk about Strout, when we talk about Llorente, is that everything becomes about events. So you're like, well, this player made this mistake, but then he did this thing that was good, and this player did this mistake, but then he did this thing that was good. And I think Pat's also a bit of a victim to that. And I think what we try and do on this channel is we try and think in terms of, you know, sample sizes. So you want to take a big chunk of evidence and say over the course of that evidence, you know, that player's done well enough. And I think, you know, the argument has to be made that both Pascal and Llorente have done enough to warrant their starting it, I think, on the basis of the sample size in the team. Pat Bamford is someone who, again, is someone who I think all of us would agree this season that he's justified his starting position based on the sample size. But the problem is every time he hits, same with Tyler Roberts as well, who's a player that we're going to talk about in a minute. But every time there's a chance that they do something bad, then we have to go through the whole conversation again about whether or not they're justifying their place in the team. So Pat is another player who's like that, had a bit of a poor game yesterday. And so obviously there's been a few questions about that. So Neil Harding says, has Bamford forgotten what made him so successful at the start of the season? Seems hesitant, lack of confidence, overthinking, just needs to get his shots away. Unlucky hitting the crossbar though. Claudio Aravena says, was Bamford really off his pressing timing this game, or did it just look like that due to Liverpool's defence constantly breaking through the press but driving forward with the ball? Let's go to you on this one, Tom, first. What do you make of Bamford, or what did you make him yesterday? And I guess with an eye to what I was talking about that bigger sample size, like, do we worry about him based on the sample size, or is this just a one-off which we shouldn't really think about that much?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't think he had a very good game. It was definitely one of his poorer games this season. I do think he's been a little bit off it the last few games. Ever since he played in that game where he wasn't fully fit, I can't remember which game that was. I'm just not sure that he's quite 100% fitness. It feels like maybe he's being played through a minor injury or something. I don't know if there's any truth in that or not, but I must admit, the last few games, he's not looked quite as sharp to me. And I don't mean missing chances. I just mean his touch has not been quite as good. He's been a little bit late to balls and things like that. I mean, he's not been terrible by any means, but I do think he's had a little bit of a drop-off in the last few games. That's not to say I think he should be dropped. I think as long as he is fit, which I don't, you know, I guess I have to assume that he's not being played against his will or anything like that, is he? So I you know, you just play him through it and it'll come good again, I'm sure. I just wonder if the physical thing is impacting on his performances, but I don't have any evidence for it.
I'm just trying to think, when was the last time he scored?
Was it just before an international break that he played when he wasn't fully fit? That's what I sort of remember.
Yeah, well, it was just before the international break that he got injured. I'm just trying to work out when that was. Was it the Chelsea game? Or was it the Fulham game?
Fulham, I think.
So he gets injured in the Fulham game, and then he's a little bit under par for the Sheffield United game. And then the other two games are City and Liverpool, which
it's only three games I'm talking about. Yeah.
You wouldn't really get too worried if your striker is not scoring in games against City and Liverpool. So yeah, and he's a streaky striker as well. We talk about this a lot. He'll go through a phase of scoring a few and then have a bit of a dry spell. But I think that's kind of what I would put it down to. It's a couple of tough fixtures. I mean, 45 of the minutes that he played against. Right, I guess he got hooked, didn't he? But he got hooked at halftime. Was it halftime against
just before,
City?
Yeah.
So I think it would be harsh to judge him on the first half against City when we got hammered basically in that time frame, and then a game against Liverpool where, you know, we very much have started just being quite counter attacking. I think as well that's the story of the season, right? In the first part of the season we did try and build up a little bit more solidly, and since then we've gradually become a little bit more counter attacking, and that means that he's not going to get a huge amount of chances. He's also not going to get the best kind of chances, perhaps. So I don't really have any worries about Pat. How about you, Jim?
Yeah, I'm not really that worried. I mean, he could have easily scored yesterday with that lob over Alisson, which was the perfect decision to make. The ball just set up nicely for the dink over, and he was really unlucky that it didn't even bounce off the crossbar and just go across the line. And then in the first half, his 1v1, it was just a heavy touch, really. And he was also crowded out by three players. So even if his first touch was good enough, I'm not sure whether he would have scored that one. In terms of the pressing yesterday, I think it's just difficult when you look at the opposition, just the way that Liverpool want to play. I mean, I haven't watched the game back, so this is pretty anecdotal, but I think the centre-backs stand a lot further apart than most centre-backs, and the full-backs get much higher up the pitch. And if Bamford's pressing both centre-backs, because that is his job, is to be man-marking both of them and curving his runs and to block one of them off and that kind of thing, when they're that far apart, I think it's just really difficult. And if he's marking one and then the other drives through the centre of the pitch and he's miles away, then he can't really do anything about that. So I think if we were to play a team like Crystal Palace, for example, whose centre-backs are quite narrow and the full-backs just sit, then his pressing would look a lot better because of that.
I think that's become something that clubs have done against us the whole season since we've been in the Premier League, has been splitting their centre-backs really, really wide, because it forces the striker really to not be able to press both of them at once. So the striker will have to sort of do that rolling press that we talk about with the 10, so dropping back onto the defensive midfielder and then pushing the other player across. So yeah, I think it's been said before, like, is it Scott Parker or was it Steve Cooper who said that Leeds are just really scripted, which is true. And so I think that there's become like quite a standard way to play against Leeds, and I don't think it benefits Bamford really as well in the pressing side of things. I'm aware of time, so let's move on. There were some questions about Jan Pavada, but I think we've talked a little bit about Jan Pavada. So let's talk about Tyler Roberts, because we've been advocates of Tyler Roberts on this channel for a while this season. Yesterday was a game, I would say, that made it hard to be a Tyler Roberts stan. I don't think it was his strongest game. The trainee RQT says, will Roberts ever score? And Jip says, did Tyler Roberts do enough to justify his position in the starting lineup for the remaining games? Was it worth bringing Click or Hernandez back in so that Tyler can get a pre-season in behind him and start afresh? I'll go to you on this, Tom Woodhead. What do you make of Tyler Roberts at the moment?
I don't think he was very good against Liverpool, but I think he's generally been good in the games before that, and I think it'd be pretty harsh to drop him for one bad performance. Obviously, he should have done a lot better with that chance. But he still did do a couple of decent things in the game. He wasn't uniformly terrible. And considering Rodrigo's still injured, and Pablo, I don't think, is going to be up to the pace of 90 minutes in the Premier League. And we're still not 100% sure about the fitness status of Click, although he looked, you know, he looked fine when he came on yesterday. I'd keep Roberts in the team for now. I think you really risk ruining a player's confidence if you start dropping them after one bad game. And I think that's why Bielsa does take a long time to drop people in general. Mm. So I would leave it as it is for now. But you leave the door open for Click, because I think Click does bring some things to our team that Roberts doesn't. So, you know, I wouldn't be particularly adverse to having Click in the team instead of Roberts. But as it is, it just feels really harsh, especially considering we've got Manchester United next. So, you know, you drop him for Leeds' biggest game of the season in some ways for one bad performance, again, really harsh. And then after that, we've got Brighton, who play three at the back. So you want Roberts in the team for that probably anyway, because he's going to be the best at playing that sort of second striker role. So, yeah, I think stick with him for now.
I think that it was Josh Hobbs who said yesterday that Tyler Roberts is someone who seems to benefit from having Rafinha in the team. Rafinha creates a lot of space, drags players towards him as well, that allows Roberts to do good things in the middle. And I think it was noticeable yesterday that without Rafinha, that Roberts was maybe a little bit less impressive. I'm just having a look through. One more question I think we'll do before we have to wrap things up from Simon Kaiser, who says, why can't we hit the man more often at corners? I think this is a good question. I was thinking this yesterday during the game, actually, that we had that game where Rafinha was putting on Pascal Strauch's head every single set piece. And I thought, you know, here we go. This is going to be great. We're going to be scoring from set pieces all the time. Weirdly, yesterday, I felt the set pieces were largely quite poor. And then we went and scored from one. So I'll put this over to you guys. Why do you think we can't hit the man more often at corners?
I think it's quite a hard thing to do, first and foremost. I mean, I think when I was reading through the comments on the All Stats Aren't We page, seeing what the questions were going to be, I think one of the replies to this was that we've had about 150 corners this season and we've scored three of them. But actually, that's about right for when you look at corner statistics, how many of them result in goals. I think it's about 2 or 3%. So you would be looking at 2 or 3 out of every 100 corners. So 150, you know, 3 is maybe slightly on the low side. You might be looking for 4. But even then, I think we're about bang on. And I think it's maybe just a skill that is hard to appreciate as football fans, because I totally feel the same, that, you know, why can't we just whip in the ball and land it on their heads? But I think it's just one of those things that's much harder than it looks. And the goal yesterday was the result of a fantastic ball in from Harrison. And almost as soon as he hit it, you could see it was landing in that area where there were three Leeds players in that small zone just on the edge of the 6-yard box. And maybe Alisson should have come to claim it, but it looked like it was going to result in a really big chance. And yeah, I think maybe it's just quite a difficult skill to hit the man every time.
Yeah, I think if you stuck a player on their own in the penalty box and told a Leeds player to hit them hit their head from the corner spot, they would probably do it most of the time. The point is that there's a whole team of other people trying to stop you from doing that. And so there is definitely a need to whip balls in now. And when you whip balls in, if you're hitting them with your laces, then there's a lot bigger margin for error. You're also hitting the ball a lot flatter. So, you know, the margin for error is increased there as well. So I think it comes down to that, because I think people kind of think, oh, well, you know, just float it in and hit people on the head. But if you do that, centre-backs are just always going to, either the keeper's going to get it, number one, or the opposition centre-backs are just going to be able to clear it out. You've got to try and get that speed on it. You've got to try and get that whip on it. And that just makes it very, very difficult, which is one reason why you often see the ball not clearing the first player on the post. And so that you get a lot of fans who are frustrated, because you'll see sides who always seem to hit the first man and it just gets cleared away. But again, you're trying to hit that area with speed so that someone can run in front post and get something on it so that it goes back across the box. So yeah, it's just a really difficult thing to do. I think it was maybe a couple of seasons ago where we moved from the likelihood of scoring from a corner as an attacking team being overtaken by the likelihood of scoring from a corner from a defending team. So you're more likely now, I think, to score a goal on a counter-attack than you are from a corner, than you are to score from your own actual corner. So it's definitely a really difficult skill to do. Tom Woodhead, do you have any thoughts on corners?
No, I was going to say the exact same thing about the first man that you did. Like, you know, you get so many people grumbling, these people are getting paid 40 grand a week and they can't get past the first man in the corner. But if you just float it into the back post every time, then it doesn't matter if you hit the man, because the man isn't going to do anything with it, is he? So
right, I think we should end with just a note from our positive correspondent Dan Holdsworth. He had a few positives for us. So he said, great to see the team adapt and come back after a poor first half. Global capitalism is showing itself for what it truly is to a whole new audience. The pitch, no one's talking about the pitch anymore. It's performing quite well now. And then Pascal is beautiful. I don't know if you guys have got anything you'd like to add in terms of the positives from the game yesterday.
No, I would say actually, yeah, I realised halfway through the second half that I'd barely noticed the pitch at all. So, you know, well done whoever's been looking after that.
Yeah, we'll be back next week to give you some more pitch updates. We haven't done it for a while, actually, but we are Leeds United's number one pitch correspondent. So no doubt there will be some update in the offing soon. I think that probably just about wraps it up for the Liverpool review. We'll be back during the week sometime with a Manchester United preview, hopefully, if I can find someone who wants to talk about them to a Leeds United podcast. If you like what we do and you want to get more of it, then yeah, head over to our Patreon channel. We have lots of stuff over there. I will be putting up some analysis from the game, some video analysis from the game yesterday at some point in the next couple of days, so do check that out. And yeah, I think that pretty much ends this podcast. So all there is for me to do is to say thank you, Tom.
Thank you. I'm off to join a different super podcast.
Hey, you're going to try and consolidate all of the huge amounts of money that is available in football.
I just feel like I'm wasted, like dealing with these minnows every week.
Yeah, thank you to our other minnow, Joe.
Thanks very much.
And we'll see you in a few days' time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.